This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sarah Waters, is the author of three lesbian-themed novels set in Victorian England, Tipping the Velvet, Affinity, and Fingersmith, which was nominated for England's prestigious literary award, the Booker Prize. Last year, the BBC showed a three-part TV adaptation of Tipping the Velvet. It will be shown on BBC America over the Memorial Day weekend. The screen adaptation was written by Andrew Davies, who also did the BBC's Pride and Prejudice and Bridget Jones' Diary. Tipping the Velvet begins in 1888 when a young woman named Nan sees a music hall act featuring a woman dressed as a boy. Nan is drawn to the performer, Kitty Butler, and gets a chance to meet her backstage. Here's a scene from that first meeting.
Miss Butler?
Oh, call me Kitty, do. And what can I call you?
Nan. Thank you, you're very kind. I was going to ask, Kitty, why did you think of it in the first place? Dressing like a boy and cutting your hair short and everything.
Oh, wouldn't you if you had the chance? Men have all the fun. Besides, there's too many girls in this business. Most of them would do anything to please the manager, and you won't find me playing those games, Nan. And I love my costumes and being able to stride about and give them a bit of cheek. Don't get me wrong. I do like being a girl as well, you know.
The two women fall in love, and Nan joins Kitty's act, for which she too has to dress as a boy. But that's just the beginning of Nan's adventures in this fictional lesbian underground of the late 1800s. Here's a reading from Tipping the Velvet from a scene just before the one we heard. Nan is watching Kitty's music hall act for the first time and is amazed by what she sees.
Kitty Butler did not wear tights or spangles. She was, as Tricky had billed her, a kind of perfect West End swell. She wore a suit, a handsome gentleman's suit, cut to her size and lined at the cuffs and the flaps with flashing silk. There was a rose in her lapel and lavender gloves at her pocket. From beneath her waistcoat shone a stiff-fronted shirt of snowy white with a stand-up collar 2 inches high. Around the collar was a white bow tie, and on her head there was a topper. When she took the topper off, as she did now to salute the audience with a gay hello, one saw that her hair was perfectly cropped. It was the hair, I think, which drew me most. If I had ever seen women with hair as short as hers, it was because they'd spent time in hospital or prison, or because they were mad. They could never have looked like Kitty Butler. Her hair fitted her head like a little cap that had been sewn just for her by some nimble-fingered milliner. I would say it was brown. Brown, however, is too dull a word for it. It was rather the kind of brown you might hear sung about, a nut brown or a russet. It was almost perhaps the colour of chocolate. But then chocolate has no lustre, and this hair shone in the blaze of the limes like taffeta. It curled at her temple slightly and over her ears, and when she turned her head a little to put her hat back on, I saw a strip of pale flesh at the nape of her neck where the collar ended and the hairline began that, for all the fire of the hot, hot hall, made me shiver. She looked, I suppose, like a very pretty boy, for her face was a perfect oval and her eyes were large and dark at the lashes, and her lips were rosy and full. Her figure, too, was boy-like and slender, yet rounded, vaguely but unmistakably, at the bosom, the stomach and the hips, in a way no real boy's ever was, and her shoes, I noticed after a moment, had 2-inch heels to them. But she strode like a boy and stood like one, with her feet far apart and her hands thrust carelessly into her trouser pockets and her head at an arrogant angle at the very front of the stage. And when she sang, her voice was a boy's voice, sweet and terribly true.
Well, Sarah Waters, thanks for reading that excerpt of Tipping the Velvet. Is this a typical music hall act of the period with a woman dressing in a man's clothes?
Yes, it is very much so, and it's not something, you know, that features in mainstream entertainment today in Britain, but in the 19th century and in the Edwardian period. It was really, you know, it was big business. Male impersonation was a standard music hall act. There were very famous male impersonators. Vesta Tilly was the best known, and you know, they had fans all over the country. It was a really big deal.
I think for most of us, we're more familiar with drag acts where a man dresses as a woman. And I know that was really a staple of British music hall, and
yes.
it usually was not meant to be sexual, you know,
as no.
Like in those drag acts, like it was just comedy. So, who was the like target audience, so to speak, for the acts in which a woman dressed as a boy?
Well, that's one of the interesting things about it, I think, and especially from my point of view, because, you know, I was wanting to tell basically a lesbian story, a lesbian romance. And what strikes us today, I think, what struck me when I was looking at images of male impersonators, is that they do lend themselves, you know, to having a sort of lesbian interpretation put on them. They're very dapper. I mean, our only exposure to women, you know, images of women dressing as men today is as drag kings, is as a sort of lesbian act. But as I was saying, this male impersonation in the music hall was mainstream. It was very much directed to and enjoyed by, you know, a cross-section of society, a very family act. But I suppose I was interested in, you know, did it carry some kind of erotic charge for some spectators? You know, I suspect it did. And it was kind of what wanting to pursue that, really, that formed the basis for Tipping the Velvet, the novel.
So the main character in Tipping the Velvet, Nancy, first falls in love with one of these male impersonators in a vaudeville act. Then, you know, they become lovers, and then Nancy herself becomes part of the act, but without giving away too much of the story, not long after that, Nancy becomes a streetwalker, still dressing as a boy, as she did on stage, but this time she's for rent. Did you do research, too, on what the life of a streetwalker would have been like in the late 1800s? And also, were there streetwalkers who were women dressing as boys?
Well, that's one of the things we can never really know for sure. We know, for example, that women dressed as men, lots of women passed as men, working class women, I think, more than middle class women. We have lots of evidence about that, court records, for example, women were found out and sort of hauled before the courts. How far that went in terms of what kind of erotic encounters they were having, of course, we don't know. But I think what I was really trying to do with that part of the book is, one of the starting points of the book for me was some of the evidence we have around gay men. Men's lives in the late 19th century, and we do know quite a lot about prostitution amongst men. Oscar Wilde, for example, I mean, we know about the encounters that he had with rent boys, prostitutes. And it's a very interesting world with its own sort of codes and its own vocabulary. And I was very taken with it. And I, given the relative paucity of information we have about lesbian lives in the late 19th century, I really kind of wanted to borrow it, you know, so it seemed, after having written about male impersonation, the obvious on the stage, for me, the obvious next step was to sort of take Nancy onto the street dressed as a boy and then involve her in this other sort of underground world that people today don't know too much about.
So you're in a way kind of inventing a lesbian underground world because there's no real history of one. You kind of have to invent it?
Yes, absolutely. The book has a lot of very enthusiastic lesbian readers for whom, you know, I'm very grateful. But lesbians often read the book, I think, as sort of lesbian social history. And in fact, I did do research into lesbian history, and the book is authentic to a certain extent. But as you said, it's much more, really, it's a kind of historical fantasy. It's me sort of wanting to imagine a past for lesbians, but also to go even further than that and just invent a rich and exciting and glamorous, or at times rather seedy, history for us. I think the area where I had to do that most was around working class lesbian history, because of course middle class women tend to have left much more in the way of historical record, you know, through journals and diaries and letters. And it's with working class women that you have to read between the lines much more.
Our heroine Nancy later becomes the kept woman of a somewhat older, very wealthy woman. And the wealthy woman uses Nancy as her object of pleasure. Is this a staple of erotic literature, the young, attractive person who's taken in to pleasure the wealthy person?
Yeah, it is. And again, I think this is, you know, there are lots of different things going on in the book, and at that point in the novel, for example, I was both trying to draw again maybe on that sort of Oscar Wilde world. I mean, we know that Oscar Wilde and his upper middle class friends were very interested in sort of encounters with working class boys. That was the sort of sexual charge in their community. And so I was interested in sort of taking that for a lesbian story and seeing what happened with it. But also, of course, in this point in the book, Nancy really enters a kind of pornographic world. I mean, again, that's very deliberate. One form of representation which gives us the most vivid account of lesbianism is pornography, and it's, you know, it's authored by men. It was probably meant for male consumption, but at the same time, it does give us this very sort of rich and often quite positive representation of lesbian sexuality. And I was interested in, again, borrowing that for this story, so that Nancy moves through a whole range of lesbian worlds in Tipping the Velvet, and this pornographic world was just one other world, you know, that she moves through.
Were you able to find lesbian pornography from the Victorian era?
Yes. I mean, again, people don't know much about pornography in the 19th century, but it was big business. And there's a lot of it still around. There's a lot of it in the British Library in London. And I looked at quite a lot of it for Tipping the Velvet, and actually more for my newest book, Fingersmith, which talks about a Victorian collector of pornography. And a lot of it, lesbian representation has been a staple of male pornography since pornography began to be written, you know, and still is. And it makes it rather problematic for a lesbian readership for that reason, because often, for example, it's seen as the lesbian action is seen as a sort of prelude, you know, to heterosexual sex, that the man will step in at the crucial moment and take over. But even so, I still think there's so much energy to it that it's worth us, you know, taking it on and thinking about it and trying to use it maybe for our own ends. And it's also worth speculating about, you know, how many women were exposed to pornography? Okay, it was written by men and for men, but I imagine that women used it, prostitutes maybe used it in brothels, or women were exposed to it through their husband buying it, or women we know actually ran businesses. You know, sometimes they were involved in the production and the selling of pornography. We know that for a fact. I think it's very interesting to think about that, to remember that.
Now, you mentioned that when you were reading Victorian pornography, you realized that a lot of it was written in code, that there was an interesting, like, slang vocabulary that was used in this literature. You use some period-sounding words, and I'm not sure if they're words that you made up or if they come from the times. Let's look at some of those words and expressions, mm-hmm. such as Tipping the Velvet, the title of one of your books. Is that an expression from the period?
It is, actually, yes. I came across it first in a dictionary of historical slang. People think it's quite a sort of nice kind of phrase, and often ask me what it means. And what it actually means is it was a term for cunnilingus. And you find it in pornography too, but it was definitely in use in the 19th century, and actually is still known today. Some of my friends whose fathers have been in the services, you know, in the army or the air force, they seem to know it. So it's obviously existed in some groups even well into the sort of late 20th century.
You use the word Tom to describe a young woman who dresses as a boy. Is that a word from the period?
Tom has a fascinating history to it, yes. I must admit, this is the one word where I had to be slightly, I had to take a few liberties with history, because the word Tommy was used in the 18th century to refer specifically to lesbian women. And in the 19th century, I've come across references to it, again, in, say, dictionaries of historical slang, as meaning masculine women. It was also a term for prostitutes. There was this kind of crossover, I think, as there is in to some extent today, I think, in some communities. But I really needed a word. With Tipping the Velvet, Nancy, as I've said, moves through sort of different lesbian communities, and she starts off in the music hall, goes through a sort of upper middle class world, and ends up very much in a working class world. And I needed a term that I felt that the women would be comfortable using amongst themselves. And so used Tom. And I suspect, in fact, I'm pretty sure that women wouldn't have used it quite as freely as I suggest. But I like the force of it. And actually, it's been kind of taken up in Britain anyway. I think women are starting to use it, which is a really nice idea, that kind of people are reclaiming these words from the obscurity of history, thanks to one of my novels.
The director of the TV adaptation had to decide how explicit to make the erotic scenes from your novel.
Mm.
And the funny thing is, on the TV adaptation, right before any lovemaking scene, there's a disclaimer. The disclaimer doesn't just come at the beginning of the program. It comes before any scene that they think requires such a disclaimer, which I think is pretty funny because for some people that's a sign that they should, you know, turn off the TV and leave the room. And for other people, it's like, move closer to the TV now. That's the funny thing about those disclaimers.
I didn't realize, sorry, that it had that. That must be for the American TV.
Oh, maybe that's just for the American version.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're not even aware of that?
No, I didn't know that was. I didn't know that it happened.
Well, it kind of gets you off the hook because if anybody complains, you say, "Well, we told you, we told you that this was going to happen. We gave you the chance to turn off the TV and leave the room." Were you in on discussions about how explicit to make those scenes?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, it was an issue right from the start because the book is you know pretty explicit and has been known, you know, for its kind of frank sort of portrayals of lesbian sex right from the start. And I heard that there were plans to adapt it for mainstream TV, I kind of thought, oh, they're never going to do it. You know, it's never going to happen. But Andrew Davis was pretty keen on the sex, and he said he would only do it on condition that they kept all the sort of sexual details in, which they did. And I mean, it's done fairly tastefully, I have to say. There's nothing particularly gratuitous about it, and it is, after all, the story of sort of a young girl's sexual awakening, so it all feels kind of integral to the story. But certainly when the show was aired last autumn in the UK, there was a lot of advance excitement about the sex. In a way, I think there was slightly too much emphasis on it, because I think when the first show was aired, the BBC had a few complaints, and some of them were that it was too rude, but most of them actually were that it wasn't rude enough, given all the hype that people had beforehand.
You actually were in academia before you were a novelist, and you wrote a dissertation on lesbian fiction. Was it lesbian fiction of the Victorian era?
Actually, it was lesbian and gay fiction, and it sort of, I started off in the late 19th century, but moved sort of to different moments in the 20th century. And what I was really looking at was the idea of history in lesbian and gay writing, and actually in writing about homosexuality. I was very interested in how people's idea of an appropriate, you know, kind of lesbian and gay history and different sort of historical icons have changed as sort of popular ideas about homosexuality have changed. And so in the late 19th century, for example, people were very preoccupied with ancient Greece. Gay men would often say, basically, you know, as it was a form of defence, an apology, you know, that it was fine in ancient Greece, you know, they were all kind of having sex with each other and, you know, they were a very kind of noble and civilised bunch. And so why should it be a problem for people today? And similarly with lesbians, at the beginning of the 20th century, people like René Vivienne and Natalie Barney, living in Paris with their kind of lesbian community, lesbian salons, they were very interested in the figure of Sappho and kind of built, you know, wrote poems about Sappho. So that's what the, it was a PhD thesis, that's what the thesis looked at, was sort of changing ideas about history. And so it felt very natural for me then to just begin to write lesbian historical fiction of my own. It really progressed quite organically, sort of out of the academic work I'd done.
In your reading of historical fiction, did you find a lot of stories in which friendships and, you know, old maids living together seem to really be about lesbian relationships, like covert lesbian relationships?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when you look at the 19th century, passionate friendships between women were sort of, you know, standard in the 19th century, and you'll often find letters written between women. Women wrote poems to each other. Women who were even married, you know, would still maintain. I mean, I think over here, you know, you have the Boston marriage tradition. You know, I mean, quite sort of well-respected, and as I say, quite passionate friendships between women would be tolerated in society. In a way, today, you know, those friendships would be far more suspect. And this is one of the fascinating things for me about thinking about lesbianism in the 19th century, because, you know, sexual relationships between women were pretty hidden. But at the same time, for that very reason, I think there was a certain freedom for women. You could get away without having a label slapped on you. And today, for all that we have, there's a great kind of political significance and the great, liberation to being able to label yourself lesbian or gay or bisexual, and to find communities and to be able to act politically under those labels. I think we're far too eager today to put people, I think, in boxes. And when you go back to the 19th century, there was a greater fluidity around sexuality that I think was more genuinely liberating, really, for some people.
Sarah Waters, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Waters, author of the Victorian lesbian trilogy of books, Tipping the Velvet, Affinity, and Fingersmith. The three-part BBC adaptation of Tipping the Velvet will be shown on BBC America over the Memorial Day weekend.